I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is U.S. Congressman Ron Barber, just back from his first trip to Israel. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and we introduce our new Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. So this morning I was thinking about how we go about changing the world and how long should it take. This is the Jewish season just before Rosh Hashanah when we look at our lives and seek to change them for the better. But we also need to look at our society and think about how we can bring about positive change. The Torah gives us powerful commandments about how to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, the stranger. We are to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern, to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. And we are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, to uphold it, cherish it, make it our own. We're told that blessings will be ours if we do this, and curses will come on us if we can't. That Jewish covenant is large and challenging. It puts real responsibilities on the members of a society to do things that aren't easy or obvious, even if they are right. No doubt the ancient Israelites sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes, to make that pilgrimage to the temple to declare their gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were many times when they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to a high standard, made them better people and made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, a return to the right course. Positive social change was not instantaneous, but evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors, and it was codified into law as a practical framework by the rabbis at the time of the Talmud. And it is at the very heart of what Judaism has to teach the world. Which seems particularly appropriate this week as we mark the 50th anniversary of the famous March on Washington, when America mobilized to seek civil rights, including voting rights for all Americans, and particularly for African Americans. It was at that remarkable assembly, perhaps 500,000 strong, the largest demonstration in American history to that point, that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. In so many ways, our own society has taken huge leaps since Dr. King's speech that were not even envisioned in 1963. We now live in an American society in which the rights of minorities, women, gays, lesbians, and others are accepted as fact. We have gone from a country in which many, if not most, blacks were prevented from even voting for president to a country in which our president is an African American. We've gone from Jim Crow laws and open discrimination against Jews, Hispanics, Asians, and homosexuals to a place in which gays and lesbians can publicly marry, in which the Supreme Court of our nation actually looks like America. The Trayvon Martin case demonstrates we still have a ways to go, but the process that the Torah established so long ago and the direction of social change here in our own country teach us that with steady moral pressure, mixed with some patience, injustice can indeed be overcome, and the society that Dr. King dreamed of half a century ago can be created. It is a reminder that we can't be fatalistic about our own country's incapacity to improve, and we should not become complacent that this is the best that things can ever be. Making a better world depends upon us, and it is our responsibility and our duty to work to that end. In other words, in Jewish terms, we can and must improve this world, do tikkun olam. So to play us in this morning, as part of our pre-Rosh Hashanah preview of High Holy Day music, here's a different kind of Jewish New Year song from the wonderful a cappella group The Maccabees, a parody of One Direction, called The Book of Good Life. That was the Maccabees singing The Book of a Good Life for the coming holiday of Rosh Hashanah starting September 4th. This Saturday night, by the way, is Slichot, the formal beginning of the season of return, and really the earliest of the High Holy Days. When we return on To Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our friend, U.S. Congressman Ron Barber, who has just returned from his own first trip to Israel with some remarkable observations. Hear them right here on To Jewish.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our good friend Congressman Ron Barber. He's the congressman of Arizona's 2nd District in the U.S. House of Representatives, serving now in his own term, with which he was elected last year. He had to go through two full elections in not very long at all. Ron just returned from Israel, his very first trip to Israel. Welcome, Baruch Haba.
It's really great to be back in Tucson, but I have to tell you, it was wonderful to be in Israel.
It's very hard for me to leave Israel and come back, I have to say. This is your first trip to Israel.
It was my first trip, and it won't be my last, I can assure you. It's an amazing country. The people are really fantastic. And I really, you know, before I went there, I, as a member of the House Armed Services Committee, member of Congress, who is interested in national security, both ours and Israel's national security, I was very much involved with briefings and hearings on Israel and what we could do to help its national security. One thing to have sort of that knowledge and, if you will, an intellectual understanding of the situation, it's so much different to go there and see it in reality. And that's why I'm so glad I went. I know a lot more now. I have a deeper understanding of the issues and the concerns of the Israeli people now.
You know, it's sort of stunning. We think about Israel as the Holy Land, the land of the Bible, a biblical place, but it's an extraordinarily modern country.
Oh, my gosh, it is. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to go was to connect with the high-tech industry because, as you know, here in Tucson, Southern Arizona, we have a lot of high-tech companies. We have bioscience. We have defense industry. We have solar energy companies. And we have the incredible University of Arizona research and development projects. Arizona U of A is ranked 19th in the country as a research university. So when I went to Israel, I wanted to connect with those comparable industries, and we had a good opportunity to do so, meeting with people from a newly formed organization that's trying to bring together high-tech companies. It's called Startup Nation, Inc., comes out of the book Startup Nation.
Which is on the shelf over here. I've interviewed the author. You know, one of the interesting aspects about Israel is tremendous energy and innovation.
Absolutely.
Something we're maybe trying to import into Southern Arizona or just match up?
Well, I want to bring partnerships together on a couple of different levels. First of all, I'm very interested in the defense of Israel. Was before I went, even more so now, having gone to the Gaza Strip, not into Gaza, of course, but to a community just outside of Gaza, went to a high point to look into Gaza City, realizing how close it is that rockets come from Gaza, as they did last November.
Yeah, it's like Tucson to South Tucson. Yeah,
absolutely. 1,500 rockets came in, as you know, Rabbi, and 83% of them were intercepted by Iron Dome. So I was very interested in talking with the representatives of Rafael, the company that manufactures Iron Dome.
The big defense industry company.
Yeah, and then also with Prime Minister Netanyahu, we had an opportunity to meet with him. I wanted to know if co-production in the United States was a real option. We've been talking about it for some time. And I was very pleased with the Prime Minister's response. He said, "I want physical co-production." Physical meaning you do it here in the United States as well as in Israel, as opposed to just exchanging technological information and ideas. And for us in Southern Arizona, this could be a real boon to our economy because there is a relationship already with Israel and with Rafael from Raytheon. Raytheon, I think, is in a great position to be a co-producer of Iron Dome. And seeing it now as it protected Israel and the people of Israel so well, we have to have a backup production facility, and I hope it's going to be in Tucson.
Yeah, I think there's only a future growth for that. I should also note Iron Dome was used while you were there, I think, to stop a rocket coming in from the Sinai aimed at a lot.
That's the first time
it's been used in the south of Israel. We will talk much more with Congressman Ron Barber about his trip to Israel and perhaps the Israeli-Palestinian peace process as well when we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Exactly 100 years ago today, August 25th, 1913, a 31-year-old factory superintendent in Atlanta, Georgia, Leo Frank, was wrongly convicted for murdering a young female employee, Mary Fagan. That miscarriage of justice led 2 years later, also in August, to Leo Frank's lynching by a mob of white Southerners. August was not a kind month in this respect. So far as I can determine, the first Jew lynched by the Ku Klux Klan, a dry goods store owner named Beerfield, was hung in Franklin, Tennessee in August of 1868. Nearly 50 years later, in August of 1915, a Jewish writer, Albert Bettelheim, convicted of murder in Georgia as well, was lynched 2 days before Leo Frank. According to various sources, two other Jews were lynched by Southern mobs in the 1890s. We don't seem to know their names or the exact month, but the late heat of summer certainly seems to lead to such atrocities. While these five Jews represent a minuscule fraction of the number of Americans lynched by the Klan and white mobs, and not just in the South, in U.S. history, they do demonstrate that our full acceptance into American society was far from automatic. And they show as well that an egalitarian, just society under the rule of law, guaranteed by a strong government, is clearly of benefit to all Americans, and perhaps particularly so to minorities like us Jews. There is no way to compare the tragedy of the widespread lynchings of African Americans in the South to the isolated cases of Jews similarly tortured and murdered. But for those who imagine that this land of liberty was always so accepting a place, these sad memories, now 100 years old for Leo Frank, are a reminder that our dedication to civil liberties has been well justified by history. The Leo Frank case is by far the most famous incident of persecution of a Jew in American history. The facts, while not crystal clear after a century, are that Frank, a trained engineer raised in Brooklyn who had a degree from Cornell, was the Jewish superintendent of a pencil factory in Atlanta. Mary Fagan, a 13-year-old factory assembly worker, was murdered in the basement and her body discovered. The investigation was badly botched by Atlanta police, who, in spite of evidence that a night watchman actually killed her, eventually settled on Leo Frank as the best suspect. Evidence was lost, tampered with, destroyed, and withheld, even given to reporters, and then it disappeared. And under pressure to find and convict a murderer, the authorities settled on the unpopular Jewish boss. After a showy trial, with the prime evidence against him, the perjured testimony of the most likely real murderer, Leo Frank was convicted and sentenced to death. Through the open courthouse windows, the jury could hear the Georgia mob outside chanting, "Kill the Jew!" The case was appealed up to the Supreme Court of both Georgia and then the U.S., but neither would intercede, although dissenting opinions of both decisions declared that this was the kind of judicial lynching in an atmosphere of intimidation and profound anti-Semitism that should never happen. In a final courageous act, the retiring governor of Georgia, whose name should be remembered, John Slayton, reviewed all the evidence, and on the day before Frank was supposed to hang, he commuted his sentence to life, saying, "I cannot stand the constant companionship of an accusing conscience, which would remind me that I, as governor of Georgia, failed to do what I thought to be right. Feeling as I do about this case, I would be a murderer if I allowed this man to hang. It may mean that I must live in obscurity the rest of my days, but I would rather be plowing in a field for the rest of my life than feel that I had blood on my hands." Slayton had been a popular governor of Georgia, but after this decision, he had to be protected by the Georgia National Guard, and he and his wife left the state immediately, never to return, after his term ended 5 days later. In August of 1915, again August, a mob incited by former U.S. Congressman Tom Watson, and including a former two-term governor of Georgia, two former Superior Court justices, several ex-sheriffs, and at least one lay preacher, the mob kidnapped Frank from prison, drove him to Mary Fagan's hometown of Marietta, brutalized him, hung him to death, vandalized his corpse, and took souvenir photographs and items. There were several important results of this lynching of Leo Frank, the last recorded lynching of a Jew in America. First, the Atlanta Jewish community, which felt at the time that it was fully accepted into Southern society, received a blow to its self-confidence that did not fully heal until after the Civil Rights Movement. Secondly, B'nai B'rith, the important Jewish organization, was energized in a unique way. Leo Frank had been president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith. In the wake of his unjust conviction in 1913, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, was founded. It has worked hard and successfully to counteract anti-Semitism and other forms of religious and racial persecution in America for almost a century. 10 years ago, at the ADL's 90th anniversary, a plaque was erected that read, "The trial of Leo Frank in 1913 was motivated by the rampant anti-Semitism of the time. The founding of the Anti-Defamation League that same year was motivated by a passion to eradicate such injustice and bigotry. Despite his innocence, Frank was abducted from jail in 1915 and lynched. The ADL remembers the victim Leo Frank, rededicates itself to ensuring there will be no more victims of injustice and intolerance." On this 100th anniversary of Frank's wrongful conviction, and the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, may we dedicate ourselves anew to the social contract that America needs to maintain with all citizens, to become a society in which prejudice based on race, creed, and color can no longer be acceptable, and in which the rule of a just law exists for all. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll meet our new Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish a new representative of Israel in our community and on the Two Jewish radio show. Her name is Oshrat Bar-El, and while in the past a representative of Israel is always known as a shaliach, she is a shlicha, a female representative of Israel in America. She's head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, welcome.
Boker Tov, Rabbi Sam.
Oshrat, you come from Beit She'an, which is a city of great historical importance, but not terribly well known here in America. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're from and your experience in becoming a representative of Israel in America?
Yeah, actually, I was born and raised in the city called, which called Beit She'an in the north of Israel, close to the border with Jordan. And it's a small city with almost 19,000 residents. Most of them came from North Africa at the earlier 1950s.
In the 1950s.
Yeah, thank you.
Early 60s, right?
Yeah. Moroccan, some from Iraq. My parents and grandparents came from Morocco. Small, with small city, as I said, with the same weather as here.
Hot, that is?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I thought there is no place in the world it's hotter than Bet She'an, but now I understand that there is.
Now you live in Tucson, you know it is.
Yeah.
Bet She'an was a great Roman city, Byzantine city, has a fantastic amphitheater, which is also a site of modern concerts today in Israel.
Yeah. Actually, for the last 4 years, the site has a sound and light show that is now considered to be the third, like, famous and at the whole world.
Wow. The third best light show in the whole, third best son de lumière, they say in French, the third best sound and light show in all of the world, not just Israel. How did you go through the process of becoming, how does someone become a shlicha? How do you become a representative of Israel in America?
Actually, I'll tell you about my way.
Please.
Like, I worked for the past 5 years for the Jewish Agency as director of partnership between Cleveland, Ohio, and two localities in Israel. But I know that others, shlichim, came from all different areas and different, you know, works. But I see my shlichut as a very natural, like a next component in my my route, or I won't say career, because I do see this as a shlichut more than, you know, just a job.
Kind of as a service, a form of service to Israel.
Yeah, but it's a very natural development. I saw it.
And I should note that you have three children. Tell us about them.
Yeah, I'm married to Eli, also from Bet She'an. We together have three girls. Yuval, 12. She now is at the THA. Roni,
that's the Jewish day school here in Tucson. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Roni, she's 9 at fourth grade, also at the THA. And we have Shira. She's 3 years old, and she's going to JCC.
To the Jewish Community Center preschool.
Preschool.
That what we call in Israel the gun.
Yeah.
We are delighted to have you. We look forward to your observations on not only life in Israel, but the experience of an Israeli understanding of the American Jewish culture. We look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, this week marked the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the sort of high point of the civil rights movement in America. When Americans think about civil rights, they think about it in America, but it's a global issue. And for Jews, it goes back to Deuteronomy, where we assert the equality of human beings, at least within some limits. Can you give us kind of an overview on what human rights means in the world today?
Right. There's probably some confusion in the minds of many of our listeners between civil rights and human rights. And I think when we first saw the emergence and the growth of the civil rights movement in this country, it was about racial equality and rectifying some of the imbalances and the past injustices in relations between what, just to use a shorthand term, could best be called Black Americans and white Americans. The politically correct terms have changed over the years.
Of course.
Many times, actually. But in those days, we didn't necessarily think in terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We weren't necessarily thinking about people with physical handicaps. We weren't necessarily thinking about gender equality. I mean, civil rights actually came in some ways before women's lib. And we certainly weren't thinking about gay rights in those days, or about the rights of elderly people to get jobs without discrimination. And I mean,
ageism, all of the issues
right.
of society.
We've certainly done a lot of consciousness raising in our own country over the past 50 years in terms of a broader definition of human rights as opposed to civil rights, and specifically the civil rights that used to be code for
African Americans.
Right, lowering some of the barriers that separated blacks and whites, particularly like busing and integrating schools. And
voting.
Right, right. Although that recently has come under some threat, some renewed threat, and it shows that, you know, deep cultural and social change is a long, slow process, even here, and we can't really reasonably expect countries that have little tradition of democracy and respect for human rights to do a better or faster job than we've done of this kind of social and cultural transformation, which is profound. That being said, you know, a quick glance around the world shows that there are some countries where even basic human rights or civil rights are not recognized even as a goal, whereas in other countries they are accepted as a goal. But it's a goal that remains elusive, and the full achievement of that goal is far off. So, I mean, let's, we may have to do this next week, but let's look more closely at Europe, broadly speaking, and some of the institutions that exist to promote and protect human rights in Europe. And then the rest of the world, which in some ways and in some places is way ahead of Europe and in other places way behind. And I think one of the things we're seeing with the so-called Arab Spring now is how hard it is in countries which have no tradition of respect for human rights and promoting greater human rights to make the kinds of transformations we had hoped were getting underway with the beginning of the Arab Spring.
Very interesting, big topic. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish Humor, Your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Miriam goes to see Dr. Levy to ask his advice on how to revive her husband Joseph's libido. So, have you tried Viagra? Asked Dr. Levy. It works wonders. There's no point in me trying to get Joseph to take a Viagra pill, replies Miriam. He won't take any pill, not even an aspirin. Well, that doesn't have to be a problem, says the doctor. You can give Joseph Farborgen Viagra. What is Farborgen Viagra? She asks. It's when you drop the tablet in his coffee when he's not looking. He won't know it's there or taste it, I promise you. Give it a try. Then call me, tell me how it goes. 3 days later, Miriam phones Dr. Levy. Tells him, I did what you told me. So, Miriam, asks Dr. Levy, did it work? Did it work? She asks. Oy vey, did it work, but it was horrible. Really? Why? Well, I did as you said. I put the Viagra in his coffee when he wasn't looking. He starts to drink the coffee, jumps straight from the chair, looks at me with a smile on his face, a twinkle in his eye, swoops me in his arms before I can do or say anything. He rips off my clothes and makes mad, passionate love to me then and there on the table. Wow, says Dr. Levy, it worked. Why do you say it was horrible? Oh, it was the most amazing, most passionate, most satisfying thing I ever experienced, says Miriam. So, no, what was wrong? Asks the doctor. We can never go in that kosher restaurant again, replies Miriam. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This coming week, we celebrate the final Shabbat of the year. That means our Torah portion is one of the great sections, the doubled portion of Nitzavim Vayelech. It begins, you stand here today, all of you, the oldest to the youngest, wealthiest to the poorest, the most famous to the humblest, leaders of your community and strangers visiting with you. You are all part of the covenant with the Lord your God, you and every generation to come who will be descended from you. This great Brit, this covenant, affirms that we will be God's people and God will be our Lord. It confirms that we are part of a profound and eternal tradition, a connection to our ancestors that will be carried forward to our descendants. Each of us, all of us, are part of this remarkable compact. It's an extraordinarily democratic and egalitarian agreement with God, a breed shared with everyone, regardless of gender or age. Children and women stand with men, not always the case at the time of the Torah, even today. It's a very special covenant. But what is the content of the mitzvah we are to observe? Well, at the climax of the portion, we're told, Ki ha-mitzvah hazot asher anochi mitzavcha hayom lo niflet hi mimcha. Look, this mitzvah I command you today is not too awesome for you. It's not beyond your reach. It's not in the heavens that you should say, who among us can go up to heaven and take it for us and teach it to us to do it? It's not across the sea that you should say, who among us can cross over the sea and bring it back to us that we may do it? No, it's very close to you, already in your mouth and in your heart, to do it. As Rabbi Larry Kushner says, the Torah is not somewhere else. It's already in us. We're made of it. Torah is coded into our protoplasm, our DNA. That's why it feels so good to live by the Torah, the way of all being. We're just doing what we've been designed for from the beginning. Perhaps the mitzvah that Nitzavim speaks about is no more than becoming aware of the presence of the Torah in our midst, or more precisely of the presence of God in the center, here, now. In this season, as we prepare for our tshuva, our return and repentance, if we know that God is here right now, then tshuva is a way of becoming aware that Torah is in our mouths and hearts. This may truly be the mother of all mitzvot, of all commandments. For all the other commandments are simply human refractions of that commandment, the awareness of God. Tshuva simply then means God saying, return to me. Again, become aware of me always being in your life. A great thing to remember as we approach Rosh Hashanah, and always. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Congressman Ron Barber, will tell us what he learned about Israel and the Palestinians during his first trip to the Holy Land, and find out just how the Palestinian leadership approached the congressman when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. To drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a week in which former Egyptian dictator President Hosni Mubarak was released from prison, and in which Syria was outed for using poison gas on its own citizens, there are two very different, remarkable stories about the neighbor country, Israel, and they reflect the differences between countries in that region. In Ethiopia, in a bittersweet moment, Jewish agency chairman Natan Sharansky turned over the keys to the Jewish school of Gondar to the Ethiopian city's mayor. The handover of the school, which was funded and maintained by the Jewish agency, came as the last plane flight of Ethiopian immigrants prepared to leave for Israel. In recent years, some 2,500 Ethiopian children waiting for immigration to Israel studied in the school. The Jewish agency donated all the buildings and equipment to the municipality of Gondar as they left. Jews lived in Gondar for 2,500 years, Sharansky said at the ceremony. However, their longing to return home never weakened. Today we bring to an end a journey that spans thousands of years, the conclusion of Operation Wings of a Dove. That operation was launched in November of 2010 when the Israeli government finally decided to open up to Aliyah eligibility 8,000 more Ethiopians, the Falash Mura. These Ethiopians claim to be descendants of Jews who converted to Christianity generations ago but want to return to Judaism and immigrate to Israel. They have been accepted. A steady trickle of approximately 200 Ethiopian immigrants per month has been coming to Israel since 2010. A final flight of 400 Ethiopian immigrants is set to arrive in Israel August 28th. Nearly 7,000 immigrants from Ethiopia, the majority of whom are Falash Mura, have immigrated since 2010. And in a story, another immigration one that seems like it's drawn from the 1950s, the Jewish agency reunited a family in Yemen in the Israeli city of Beersheba. The Karmis, three generations of Yemenite Jews who had been dispersed between Yemen and Argentina, arrived in southern Israel last year to put down roots. The impetus for this operation was concern for the safety of the barely 100-strong community of Jews still left in Yemen, amid growing threats from radical Islamist groups, including Al-Qaeda. These threats have intensified since the ousting of former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Since 2009, about 150 Yemenite Jews have been brought to Israel, including the group last week. This airlift was organized as soon as the Carney brothers notified the Jewish agency that they had sold their property and were ready to get out of Yemen. Their journey to Israel was complicated by the fact that the Satmar Hasidim, ultra-Orthodox Jews who are anti-Zionist, they don't believe in the state of Israel, urged Jews from endangered communities to migrate to Satmar communities in America or perhaps Argentina. The Carney family members who took up their offer left Yemen and went to Buenos Aires. They now have children who are fluent in English, Spanish, and Arabic, and will soon learn Hebrew. The Yemenite Jewish community dates back at least to the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, and many think it goes back a further 650 years to the destruction of the First Temple. While we are delighted to see that these Yemenite Jews are safe and secure in Israel now, there is something sad about the end of a great Jewish community of that antiquity. Hey, Waters, leave those yids alone. Last week, a supermodel took on a rock legend. Israeli supermodel Bar Rafeli laid down a challenge to rock musician Roger Waters after he published an open letter to his colleagues urging them to boycott Israel. Waters, the one-time frontman of the progressive rock band Pink Floyd, said, "I write to you now, my brothers and sisters in the family of rock and roll, to ask you to join me and thousands of other artists around the world to declare a cultural boycott on Israel." 2 years ago, Rafeli was a big Waters fan. In July 2011, after attending a concert of his in Paris, Rafeli tweeted that she spotted her image in a Waters show. "Crazy thing. Went to the Roger Waters show in Paris and saw a pic of myself on the wall. I'm honored." Now, following Waters' clear pro-boycott stance and active efforts on behalf of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, she has changed her tune, and Rafeli wants her image out of Waters' show. She showed her displeasure by tweeting, "Roger Waters, you better take my picture off of the video art at your shows. If you're boycotting, go all the way." Frankly, given that choice, Waters should quit the boycott and keep Bart Rafeli's video. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Congressman Ron Barber. He's the congressman of Arizona's 2nd District in the U.S. House of Representatives. As most of you know, he succeeded our good friend Gabby Giffords after that tragic shooting in which Ron himself was wounded. He eventually was elected to fulfill the end of her term and then to his own term in Congress, which he is serving right now, just returned from a congressional trip to Israel. You know, an interesting question. I don't know if people understand how these congressional missions are arranged or how it all works, but it seems to me that the one thing that you really probably don't do on those trips is breathe or sleep. So
you're absolutely right. You know how they work. We start our day about 6:30 with a wake-up call, 7 o'clock breakfast, and off and running for the rest of the day. Usually got to bed around 11:30 or midnight and start the next day the same way. And I was exhausted at the end of the trip, but I didn't mind because we were able to pack so much in. There was never a down moment. Even when we were traveling on buses from one place to the next, we had guides who were talking to us about the archaeology, the biblical history, the political issues. It was really nonstop information. And I was taking copious notes. I took a journal continuously so I could remember it all, because I certainly couldn't without that help. So it was a fantastic trip on so many levels. And then we met people who I, you know, have come to really admire, in particular the president, Shimon Peres. What an amazing man he is.
A fantastic human being.
He's a visionary, 90 years old, as sharp as they come, very involved with science and technology in the digital age. It was really, the most important meeting, if you will, of the whole trip.
Let's talk about the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Sure. As you mentioned, you were at the borders of Gaza, looking into Gaza. Right now, we're in the midst of this new peace process that Secretary of State, former Senator John Kerry, has initiated. Tell us sort of your perspective on that process.
Well, we met with the Prime Minister and the President, and then we went to Ramallah in the West Bank to meet with the Chief Negotiator for the Palestinian Authority, Arafat.
Saeed Arafat, right.
Yeah, and the one thing that all three of them said in common was how much credit they gave John Kerry for getting them to this point of sitting down around the table. And the reason that there's hope, perhaps more than in the past, is his dedication was cited as the reason they got to the table, and they believe he will stay involved. His determination will continue to help the process move along. It's not going to be easy. As we all know, the barriers to a negotiated settlement are huge. But I really feel that there's a strong commitment. Certainly, the Israeli government has taken a big step and a big risk by agreeing to releasing prisoners, which has not been popular
unpopular in Israel, right?
And so the Prime Minister definitely stepped out there on this, and we just hope that it will lead to some productive talks. In fact, a week after we left, the talks were beginning in earnest in Jerusalem, and that would have been about a week or so ago.
Right. As a first-time visitor to Israel, you know, it's a very emotional experience for a Jew. Talk about it as a Christian, what that experience is like.
Well, going to Jerusalem, going to Bethlehem, were wonderful experiences for me and my wife, who was along with me. Just to see in Jerusalem, so in such close proximity, holy places for all of the three great world religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, was really quite remarkable. You read about it, but then to see them close to each other. And then within the Christian community, to see the splits between the Orthodox Christians and the Catholics and all the rest. It's really quite stunning. And then, since one of our guides was an archaeologist, had been an archaeologist for over 20 years and a former major in the IDF, we were able to see and hear a lot about how the biblical references fit with the archaeological evidence. It was an educational experience on so many levels, but a very devout experience for many who were along the road with us. Certainly Christians and Jews together. But I have to share another comment with you about an experience I had there. You know, back on January 8th, when I was shot and Gabby was shot, one of the things that saved my life was a bandage, a combat wound bandage, that actually was invented in Israel. And when I was there, I asked our guides, could I meet the man who invented this bandage? And then last day I was there, before we left that night, he and I had a meeting in our hotel. It was really quite an emotional experience, because we hugged and we cried a little bit together, because he, you know, he'd never met him before, and vice versa. And so to meet someone who actually resulted in a product that saved my life was pretty remarkable. But it also, again, reiterated what I learned there about the creativity and innovation that is part of Israel, a huge part of Israel. You know, Israel now ranks second only to the United States in the per capita amount of venture capital invested in high-tech industries. That's remarkable for a country as small as it is.
Yeah, 7 million people. It's yeah,
smaller
it's,
than New Jersey.
Much smaller than Arizona, about the size of Pima County.
Yeah, exactly. So it's on so many levels, it was an experience of a lifetime. And one of the other experiences there was... that was quite shocking and sobering at the same time was to visit the fortified playground that a community right next to Gaza, which of course had been funded a lot by American contributions.
Right in Sderot there, right outside of Gaza.
So we walk into this huge building. It's been fortified to the point where it can take direct rocket hits and survive. And the place is packed with moms and dads and kids. And all kinds of wonderful games and activities, and that's a good thing. But then I think to myself, as a parent, a grandparent now of 5 grandkids, would I really want my grandkids to have to play inside in a fortified building because that's the only way they could enjoy that kind of activity? I wouldn't. And yet the people who live there are not moving, you know. And this is another thing that I came away with that I really understood intellectually. The importance of a Jewish homeland, but now I really get it, because the Jews have been persecuted, exiled, killed for centuries, and they finally are home, and they're not going anywhere, including if it takes a fortified playground to have their kids enjoy that kind of playtime.
Yeah, it's you couldn't have said it. I couldn't have said it better. I don't think anybody could have said it any better. I have a former confirmation student of mine who now lives in Sderot and is a filmmaker there. And chose to live there, really, as sort of a slightly crazy but definitely pioneering ethos, a sense this is our land, we're not giving it up. What was the most memorable experience, besides meeting the guy who invented the bandage that saved your life on January 8th?
Well, there are so too many to say just one, but let me give you two. First of all, seeing the close proximity of hostility. We went to the border with Lebanon. We went to the border with Syria, and of course we went to Gaza and West Bank, for that matter. Even when we went into the West Bank, we went in armored vehicles with fully
through
protected.
All the checkpoints.
Yeah,
and so.
I didn't expect Ramallah to be such a thriving city, but it was.
Big city.
And a brand new hotel that we met in. So just to see that, if you could just look over the wall, if you will, the border wall, and there it is. There are the rockets potentially coming into Israel, so close. And so that was certainly one of the more memorable experiences and takeaways for us. But I also think, on a more positive note, the resilience of the people is really quite amazing. You know, we went to a festival in Jerusalem. It's, I think, a 5-day or 6-day festival. It was going on until almost midnight. Music, dancing, kids playing, beautiful art, works of art and crafts. And life goes on. And people walking children, walking them in buggies and all the rest. And then when we went to Gaza, the same thing. In spite of this danger, there is a sense of hope, and we're home, as I said, and joy that is really remarkable. I don't know how anyone really can do this because the danger is so constant. And so to me, it's a sort of a juxtaposition of the deep and profound danger with life goes on. And we saw so many young people there and so many kids there. It's amazing how many people choose to go there, stay there in spite of everything that they're under, the pressures they're under. So I was trying to find a word or two that would describe my experience, and I had a hard time coming up with one. But I had a talk the other morning at the JCC about my trip, and afterwards, a good friend of mine who I've known for many years came up and she said, "I think you were smitten." I said, "You got it. That's the word. I mean, it really is." And as tired as we were coming back, it really. I can't wait to go back. It is a life-changing experience.
A fantastic report. And, you know, I obviously feel the same way. I've only been there 11, 12, 13 times. I can't remember, but you've described it beautifully. Thank you for a great report on your trip to Israel, and I hope you get to go back frequently.
I can't wait to go back.
Like we say in Hebrew, the Shana Haba Birushalayim. Special thanks to Congressman Ron Barber for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Come back in a moment. You'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be two-time National Jewish Book Award-winning novelist Dara Horn, discussing her fine new book, A Guide for the Perplexed. Our playout this morning comes from Barbara Streisand. For the coming High Holy Days, less than 2 weeks from now, Janowski's classic Avinu Malkeinu, Our Father, Our King. Have compassion on us, accept our repentance, bless us with a year of goodness. My friends, go to Slichot Saturday night, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.